Chapter 1. Background. 7 months earlier, almost to the day, a gloomy autumn mist blanketed the docks of Liverpool. The early November air was chilly but crisp and invigorating. By the thousands, soldiers of the 1st Infantry Division, many of whom were hardcore survivors of bitter fighting in North Africa and Sicily, descended wooden gangways and set foot upon the venerable soil of England. A band played Dixie, followed by the sidewalks of New York. As the soldiers made their way to troop trains, a bevy of sharply contrasting emotions pervaded their ranks. Some were just happy to be out of combat. Many daydreamed about the pleasures Britain offered: pubs, beer, liquor, sightseeing, shelter, running water, but most of all, women. Some of those who had been with the division during its pre-combat training in Britain the year before looked forward to renewing acquaintances with British friends. In several instances, men were so excited that they let out spontaneous whoops of joy. You can imagine the crescendo that crushed the ears of all within miles, Captain Joe Dawson, a company commander, wrote to his family in an attempt to describe the exultation of his men. But there was an undercurrent of tension and gloom, too. The return to England could only mean one thing. The Big Red One was returning to combat, probably in the forthcoming invasion of Hitler's Europe. After nearly a year of fighting and a slew of victories in the Mediterranean theater, many of the soldiers felt they had earned the right to go home, already fiercely proud of their outfit and resentful of most outside authority. They had developed a cynical world-weariness that for some bordered on self-pity. After the Sicily campaign, hopeful rumors had spread that the division would be rotated back to the States to train new recruits. When the men boarded ships and found out they were heading to England, and thus eventually back to action, it caused, in the recollection of one rifleman, a lot of trouble among the soldiers, a lot of unrest and anger. For Lieutenant John Downing and his men, the hope of going to the States died hard. We could be sure if we didn't go home this time, we wouldn't go home until the end of the war. Many of the veterans felt this was unfair and unnecessary. They complained bitterly about the idea of going back into combat. After all, they had been fortunate enough to survive to this point. More prolonged action almost certainly meant that their chances of survival would be diminished. A man could evade the law of averages only so long before his luck ran out. Their feeling was there must be other infantry units in the United States Army that could be utilized in the assault on Western Europe, Private Steve Kelman explained. There were, of course, other units, but none quite like the Big Red One. The division's experience in amphibious assaults made it indispensable to invasion planners, not to mention its familiarity in the very sort of town fighting, river crossings, mountain fighting, and combined arms maneuver warfare that would follow in the months after the invasion. Among the American infantry divisions available for the coming invasion of Omaha Beach, none had actually assaulted a hostile shore. Lieutenant General Omar Bradley, commander of the 1st Army, with control over all U.S. ground forces in the coming invasion, knew this all too well. "Although I disliked subjecting the 1st to still another major landing," he wrote, "I felt that as commander I had no other choice. My job was to get ashore, establish a lodgment, and destroy the German. In the accomplishment of that mission, there was little room for the niceties of justice. I felt compelled to employ the best troops I had. As a result, the division that deserved compassion as a reward for its previous ordeals now became the inevitable choice for our most difficult job. In essence, they could not be spared. The task ahead was far too important and far too challenging." At Liverpool, the troops boarded trains that took them to southern England, where they would settle in and begin a new round of training. Many were miffed at the standing order to remove, for reasons of secrecy, shoulder patches and all other indicators of their unit affiliation. The lack of identifying unit insignia made them look like newly arrived stateside replacements instead of proud combat veterans. It seemed a direct affront to their pride and status. Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Wright, the division quartermaster, was so incensed at the order that he simply refused to follow it. Military police caught him, wrote him up, and referred his case to the 1st Army Provost Marshal.